Facts allow you to make decisions in unpredictable times. Get the facts you need from the Wall Street Journal. From free coronavirus updates to daily deep dives in our podcasts and videos, WSJ is a trusted source in uncertain times. Visit WSJ.com.
This is your tech news briefing for Wednesday, June 17th. I'm Kateri Yoakum for the Wall Street Journal. When it comes to fighting misinformation in elections, we still have a lot of lessons to learn from 2016. A new report released on Tuesday gives us even more insight into how one Russian firm has been operating behind the scenes. Our reporter, Robert McMillan, will join us to explain what we learned and what it tells us about how Russia could be adapting their tactics for this election cycle. That's coming up after these headlines. European Union antitrust authorities have launched two formal probes into whether Apple violated competition laws through its Apple Pay service, as well as its App Store. Our Brussels bureau chief, Dan Michaels, has more.
The commission's case began in part because of a complaint from Spotify, which is a music service. Apple has its own music service. And Spotify felt that Apple was using the platform to promote Apple Music against Spotify, and others, Deezer, some others have followed on with similar complaints. Alongside this, the commission is concerned that Apple is doing something similar with Apple Pay. One of their concerns is that if listeners have used Apple Pay, they would know that there's the touchless service you can have with Apple Pay, but other providers of payment services that might use the overall Apple platform can't access that no-touch option.
Dan says regulators see Apple's actions as part of a pattern, that these gigantic tech companies may be abusing their dominance as both platforms and service providers.
The concern is that Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google are so big and now reach into so many areas of the internet and the devices that we use that they're not just offering a service. They have become gateways. And so the companies that operate these platforms and these gateways become gatekeepers.
For its part, Apple says it's building a marketplace and that it hasn't done anything wrong. And the Federal Communications Commission said it would open an investigation into T-Mobile after customers reported nationwide network outages earlier this week. The FCC has fined cell phone carriers for service failures before, especially when they prevent customers from calling emergency services. T-Mobile acquired Sprint earlier this year, and the disruptions come as they're integrating the two networks. After the break, a new report gives us clues to how Russian hackers may be adapting in 2020. That's next.
Social distancing slows the spread of coronavirus, so we should all stay home to lower the risk for everyone. More info at coronavirus.gov. Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
We know that Russian hackers worked to influence the 2016 election in the U.S., but a lot of details about exactly how they did it and the organizations that were involved are still coming to light. On Tuesday, a new study came out showing how one group used very sophisticated techniques to avoid detection. Our reporter Robert McMillan has been looking into this, and he joins us to explain. Bob, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, it's great to be here.
All right, so this new report came out on Tuesday. Who put it out and what did it say?
Well, this is a firm called Graphica that specializes in analyzing clusters of disinformation. They had sort of been looking into this incident since last year when Facebook kind of mysteriously announced that they had taken down a small number of accounts that they had linked to Russia. And Graphica quietly, they started studying how they worked, and they started finding more and more accounts that were kind of linked to this operation. And what they found was there was an operation that had been going on since 2014, so for 6 years now, that was still active as of the early part of this year. They were spreading COVID-19 related information just a few months ago. They traced it across 300 different websites and social media platforms, so it was extremely broad. And it was very much aligned with the kind of messages that the Russian government has been putting out, sort of anti-Ukraine messages, NATO is bad, And also, remarkably to us, there were messages around the 2016 election and the 2018 midterm elections as well. So what they found was basically a third actor that was spreading disinformation back in 2016. The other two we knew about were the Internet Research Agency, which was basically a troll factory that operated on Facebook and Twitter. Also, the Russian Intelligence Agency, which hacked into the DNC and John Podesta's email and engaged in a campaign of leaking of information during the 2016 election.
So the research firm is calling them secondary infection. Do we know anything more about who these people are? And can you kind of give more specifics about what they've been specifically doing to spread misinformation?
Yeah, this is really a puzzle. And it's a puzzle with two very interesting aspects to it. One is what they call operational security. So we know from the Facebook research that this operation came out of Russia, but secondary infection has been very, very good at what they call operational security. That means they've been very good at hiding the digital breadcrumbs that internet researchers use to identify people that are doing this kind of stuff. And with the other two operations I mentioned, the IRA and the Russian intelligence, investigators were able to point the finger at who was behind those. But with this one, they don't really know the exact entity that's doing this. All they know is they're from Russia. And they have this sort of set of policy goals they seem to be trying to achieve. Now, the other side of the operation is that they have been trying to influence opinion in a way that's a little bit different from the other two that I described. They're sort of the masters of coming up with these like fake documents that they drop all over the internet. And they, you know, there might be a tweet that's been doctored to make it look like the United Kingdom is in a dispute with the United States when it's not. They're kind of dropping these fake documents all around the internet, covering their trails really well. And here's the kicker. They're not really getting a lot of attention because one of the things that allows the investigators to figure out who you are is if you build an identity that's persistent. So if you have in 2016, there was a sort of online persona named Guccifer 2.0 who was always dropping these documents. And there was another website called DC Leaks that was dropping all documents all the time. Secondary infection doesn't use those kind of cutout characters. They would just create these anonymous sort of single-use accounts and drop these fake documents and then stand back and wait for them to go viral, which they never did.
Doesn't sound very effective. Isn't kind of getting your message out part of the point?
Yeah, it's like this crazy combination of like excellent covering your tracks and like being so good at covering your tracks that like nobody even notices you coming or what you're doing in the first place, which is a really bad thing for an information operation. Now, the folks at Graphica say that they did have secondary infection did have one notable success, which was in the end of 2019. There were some documents leaked on Reddit that Graphica linked to secondary infection that apparently were legitimate documents outlining discussions between the US and the United Kingdom on trade. And those were quite widely reported in the United Kingdom, and it was sort of a big deal when they were released. So when they actually used legit documents, they got people's attention. And I think that's probably one of the things that has people really wondering about this campaign. Like, it's remarkable that they were doing all this stuff and they really didn't get noticed until 2019. And it's remarkable that when they did leak something legitimate, it actually took off.
So I guess the point is, why do we care right now? Are they doing work that is, you know, pertinent to the current situation or even 2020? I mean, obviously, the reason that the Russian hackers got so much attention was because of the 2016 election. So are people looking at them right now and these other groups as well in terms of the coming election?
You want the optimistic answer or the pessimistic answer?
I want both.
Okay. Well, the optimistic answer is that, hey, the platforms are actually doing a pretty decent job of patrolling themselves and keeping, you know, viral material from that's just nonsense from going crazy. I mean, here's a Russian operation doing all this dropping, and in order to avoid all the detection techniques that have evolved since 2016, they really had to use tactics that just prevented them from being noticed. Like, that's the optimistic way of looking at this. The pessimistic way of looking at this is there's a lot more going on than we realize, right? This operation was just like quietly like chugging along, and we don't know that they've stopped. So it's kind of worrying with the 2020 election coming up that there is this active Russian link campaign that's, you know, already been spreading disinformation about COVID, albeit somewhat ineffectively, it's still out there.
So should we be worried?
When most people hear about Russian or nation state disinformation campaigns, they get really scared. You know, it sounds like a really bad thing. Government trying to like influence opinion in another country and applying the full force of a nation state to doing a disinformation operation. And I think what people miss sometimes is these operations aren't always like as slick as we imagine. And it was funny, like some of the mistakes that these guys made were really comical, like the misspellings, like they would literally misspell the name of the person they were pretending to be in some of these posts. I think we forget sometimes that from the position of a government, this disinformation stuff is pretty cheap to do. You know, you just hire a bunch of people and let them, you know, throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and see what happens. I mean, compared to, you know, the stuff that governments spend their money on for national security, it's kind of cheap, and sometimes you get what you pay for. So you might recall last week, Twitter took down a whole bunch of Chinese-linked accounts that they say were trying to influence opinion of the Chinese diaspora around Hong Kong protesters. Well, the academics I talked to last week about that takedown said that these accounts weren't that effective either. So I think there is a sense in which this disinformation story can seem worse than it is. And that's maybe a heartening thing to take away from all of this.
And we'll be watching it, I guess, now. Our reporter, Bob McMillan. Bob, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Before we go, major tech companies have been announcing sweeping changes in response to the killing of George Floyd. We know a lot of our listeners work in tech, so we want to hear how those changes are impacting you, the employees. How has your company addressed protests? Have they implemented new diversity and inclusion policies? What changes do you still want to see? Call us and let us know. We want to hear your stories, and we may include them in the show. You can use the number in the description. And that was your tech news briefing. I'm Kateri Yoakum from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.